Hello, and welcome to Unfrozen. I'm Dan Zafarik.
And I'm Greg Lindsay. And our guest this week is Peter Apps. He is the deputy editor of UK's Inside Housing and the author of the newish book, Show Me the Bodies, How We Let Grenfell Happen, which, of course, is his documentation as a journalist of the 72 people who died in the Grenfell Tower fire on June 14th, 2017. And, of course, the reckoning that happened in the United Kingdom that followed about, well, all the things that we care about here on Unfrozen. We like to consider ourselves irreverent, but the Grenfell fire and Peter's book is all about how a combination of socioeconomic pressures, political neglect, materiality, building tall, all combined to create a tragedy. And so we're really thankful to have Peter on today to talk about the implications of the fire. And really, of course, again, what we all sort of care about here, which is how all of these systems, political, economic, and urban, are really instantiated in the form of our built environment. So thank you for joining us, Peter.
Thank you for inviting me.
I guess, obviously, let's start with, of course, the book and the fire itself. I mean, obviously, I know our UK listeners will be more than familiar with it, but for our US and for our global audience, who, of course, remember the tragedy but have not followed the implications that came from it, I guess, what is the thesis and conclusion of your book, and what is the legacy of Grenfell now?
I think the thesis of my book really was that this was a tragedy that, as I say in the title, was allowed to happen. It wasn't something that came out of nowhere. Towards the end of the public inquiry, which is recently finished hearing evidence, the barrister representing it said that there was nothing unknowable. There was nothing that shouldn't reasonably have been known among the things that occurred at Grenfell to the people who could have stopped it from happening. So really, the reason this fire happened was because various institutions either failed to act or chose not to act, and instead allowed the risks in the built environment to build up to such a point where a disaster was probably inevitable. Since the fire in the UK, I mean, part of the reason why I say that and think that is because since the fire in the UK, there's been, as you say, a huge reckoning about the safety of our high-rise buildings, the cladding systems we've used, and all sorts of other safety features. And almost every day we seem to be uncovering more and more buildings where the features that are supposed to keep people safe just are non-existent or inappropriate. And, you know, it's been in the headlines in the UK this week, but we've had to evacuate two full buildings of residents because the local fire services don't believe that they're safe. And so they've had to go off and live in hotels and wait for the buildings to be fixed at some indeterminate date. What's emerged since Grenfell is that as an industry, as a kind of government oversight of that industry, have become sort of reckless to the point of callousness and danger, really, and had placed us in a position where something like this felt something that should never have been possible in an advanced economy was not only possible but almost likely and inevitable.
I want to talk about the lead up to the event. You know, obviously it's a very long trail. It's starting with a couple of other eerily similar fires that were not dealt with properly or not really just kind of ignored the implications thereof. I don't know if there's a defining moment for you that begins the argument that this was a disaster waiting to happen. But the clear argument I think of the book is that the culture that was present that allowed Grenfell to happen came from the top, both in the industry and in the government. It seems to me, from my reading, to be embodied in the statement from January 2012 when the then new Prime Minister David Cameron said, you know, we're going to kill off the health and safety culture for good with the introduction of one in and two out legislation. Firstly, can you explain what one in, two out is? And do you feel like that was the defining moment or something else?
So one in, two out is, it essentially was a rule for government officials in the UK responsible for regulations, not just of the built environment, but of all industries, whenever they had introduced a new regulation or restriction or rule of any sort, they had to do a cost analysis. How much is this going to cost the industry to comply with it? And then they had to remove regulations to take out double that cost. So if you think there was several instances before Grenfell where there was a call to retrofit sprinklers in high-rise buildings in the UK, most don't have them. If the government had imposed that law, they'd have had to have worked out the cost of that to industry, which was quite substantial, and then removed equivalent laws to remove double that cost. And that effectively made a sort of, you know, a valuable but expensive new piece of compliance law impossible to introduce. I do think it was a defining moment, that, in answer to the second part of your question. You mentioned that the fires that kind of led up to Grenfell, there was a very tragic one in London in 2009, which killed 6 people, including 3 children. And then there was a big inquest into that fire and some recommendations to government. And I think the reason those recommendations weren't followed, or weren't followed properly, is because of that fear of regulation and red tape, as it was described by government. I don't think it's the only defining factor, is probably all I'd add to that, just because there's so many missed opportunities, missed instances, so much kind of corporate wrongdoing as well as state wrongdoing, that anytime you point to one thing and say this is the defining moment, somebody else could point to something else and say, well, actually, this is the defining moment. And really the truest position is that there were lots of defining moments, and but that is certainly one of them, and a major one.
The story is told a lot from the perspective of individuals, and I'm really curious how you got the stories of the victims and their families, as well as the very damning stories about individuals on the industry and government side who expressed very cavalier attitudes towards safety. And I'm curious, was that all from the inquiry, or did you interview these people?
It's a bit of both. I mean, I obviously, there's been a very, very in-depth public inquiry, which has commendably made all of its evidence, sort of witness statements and transcripts and all that sort of stuff, public. So as a journalist, you were obviously going to mine that resource. For some of the sort of bereaved and survivors that I include, I sort of spoke to them and spoke to their representatives, and I said, look, it might be the kind of least traumatic way for us to approach this, is if I kind of have some kind of light conversations with you and then kind of go to your inquiry evidence, as opposed to sitting you down and making you kind of relive this traumatic event again, just so that I can write a book about it. So that was the case for some of them. For a couple of others, yeah, it was direct interviews. I sat down with people and talked to them, and you know, that was it was also done during COVID, so it sort of had to be done remotely, and it's just, those are difficult interviews as a journalist, and doing them over Zoom all the more so, and in one or two instances with a translator as well. So, but people are very, very, very keen to talk about this. Well, some of them are, at least. I mean, yes, they've been through a traumatic incident. Yes, they want to move on with their lives, but they also don't want it to be forgotten, and they don't want their loved ones to be forgotten either. So I think that so long as you kind of approach them respectfully and approach them in the right way and kind of show that you're not just looking to exploit the tragedy, but to kind of shine some light on it, then you find that actually people really want to engage with that. You know, at least some of them do. In terms of the sort of the more kind of the sort of damning elements, yeah, again, some of that, I think, like, with all due credit to myself as a journalist and an investigative reporter, I don't think I'd have kind of mined WhatsApp messages between different members of an insulation firm and that sort of thing. That's, some of that stuff does come from the inquiry, but there was quite a lot that me and my colleagues dug up as well. I mean, sort of use of freedom of information laws in the UK, and then some quite old-fashioned journalism where you get to know sources who've got their hands on documents and they pass them over to you. So it was a bit of a mixture of all of those things.
But you never had a situation where you sat someone down and said, okay, you wrote this really damning sounding email, what's your perspective on it? Like, talk to me.
Sadly not. And I'd love to. And I hope that as the process develops, I will get the opportunity to ask people those questions directly. I think the thing is, at the moment, these people are very protected by legal teams. You know, they're protected by a sort of wall of corporate lawyers, and they're involved in, some of them at least, giving evidence to a police investigation as well. So they are very much not doing on the record interviews with the press. I think, like, as the years go by, that might change, and there's a few who I've kind of lined things up with because they want to give their side of it to the extent it exists. But no, sadly, the questioning was largely done by a sort of well paid but very, very competent barrister in the inquiry, and I wasn't able to get sort of one to one interviews with these people.
One more question about methodology and the development of the book itself. You said that the inquiry was just wrapping up, and I'm curious about the timing of the book and why it was released when it was released, and was there any intention of waiting for the inquiry to finish, or did we just think that was going to go on for years and years?
I mean, that's a really good question, and it's one that we put a lot of thought into. I had to wait for the inquiry evidence to get through before I could finish it. One, because otherwise it's just not a complete story, and two, because it would be quite dangerous legally to sort of write a book which might then be contradicted by later evidence. There's now a gap where there was sort of closing statements, and we're waiting for the report. Sort of two reasons really to put it out now. One is just, you know, it's five and a half years since the fire, and with every year that goes past, this feels more like history and less like a current affairs book. But it's very important, I think, because of the ongoing. This wasn't a kind of one-off self-contained issue relating solely to this building. It is affecting the policy decisions that are being made right now. And I felt like I didn't want to wait an extra year to get a report out, because it probably will take about a year. You know, an additional length of time for me to kind of incorporate that into the copy that I've written. There's also a kind of more practical sense. I think the laws differ from the US to the UK. So, but in the UK, if somebody's arrested and awaiting trial, it's very difficult to write anything that might influence the jury that ultimately make a guilty or not guilty verdict. And so after the report comes out, it's very possible that people might face arrest. And then I would not just be waiting post that, I'd be waiting until the end of the criminal trials, which could be sort of 5 or 6 years in the future. So then you're suddenly 10 years on from this event before you can kind of start explaining to readers why it happened. And I sort of felt like there's some downsides to that, again, sort of methodology here, but it means you have to caveat a lot of things. You have to put the kind of, to be quite careful around saying these conclusions haven't necessarily been reached yet and that sort of thing, and you won't have to be quite so careful after the report comes out. But there were some quite pressing reasons to get it out quicker, I thought.
Well, Peter, once the inquiry wraps, what do you expect the legacy of the fire and the inquiry itself to be, particularly when it comes to the materials involved, the insulation, the aluminum cladding? You know, what kind of regulatory change will we see, if any, particularly given the current government of the UK? Because from a professional standpoint, it sort of goes back to is sort of hopefully reforms will literally be made in terms of the materials, how they're deployed. What do you think we'll actually see in terms of the codes that will be adopted following Grenfell?
Well, we actually, you know, because it's one of these funny things. I mean, the inquiry is moving at one pace, and then the kind of reform agenda post-Grenfell is moving at a faster pace. And so we have already seen some changes to building codes in the UK. A year after the fire, the government did take a decision to ban the use of combustible cladding and insulation products on buildings above 18 metres in height. That was a sort of slightly fraught process where they actually didn't want to do that. They ran a kind of independent report, investigation separate to the inquiry, which said that wasn't necessary. It's not necessary to introduce prescriptive regulations. You just need to make sure everybody's competent. And so they said, oh, okay, well, no need for more red tape on industry then, so you won't have to. But there was a fairly furious response to that, not just from the bereaved and survivors, but from some industry groups as well who felt like these products weren't appropriate. And the government caved to pressure, basically, and did implement a ban. That ban's then kind of, it's sort of extended a little bit to include lower buildings, but with lower buildings in height, but with some caveats on. But there's other areas where the UK building codes haven't really moved fast enough or at all. We still don't really, I think a very important part of Grenfell, aside from the cladding, was the failure to evacuate the building. And that's because there's this reliance on sort of defend in place / stay put strategies. And we remain quite reliant on those in the UK. You know, we still don't really know how to evacuate buildings. We still don't build fire alarms or retrofit fire alarms into buildings. So if there is a fire in the middle of the night, it's very difficult to see how the fire services will wake people up to get them out. And sort of areas like that, I think the inquiry report needs to demonstrate to government the steps it should take, and that is one of the things that we're going to see. The sort of various expert witnesses are giving evidence and recommendations right now, actually in the next couple of weeks, so that's an area which is still moving.
The industry vanguard is increasingly toward performance-based regulation and engineering, but it seems like performance-based engineering has come in for a bit of criticism in this book owing to the fact that it really left industry to its own devices, and there was quite a bit of confusion about what was and wasn't banned in these cladding systems. Can you comment a bit on that?
Yeah, I certainly can. I mean, it is a big part of the story. In the UK, in about 1985, we moved to what was at least in name a prescriptive-based system. That was part of the kind of the overhaul of the economy that Margaret Thatcher was undertaking, sort of similar to Reagan in the US. So the official, in a kind of legal basis, the only requirement for a high rise, the walls of a high rise building, was that they should adequately resist the spread of fire. And that was up to the builder really to decide how that applied and what it meant. And that was done for the reasons you describe. I mean, they wanted, you know, we were moving into an era of new shopping malls and new innovative building designs, and they didn't want anymore to be the state ordering architects and designers how to develop their buildings. The thing is, it was never completely a performance-based system. They also had these sort of non-mandatory building codes that were quite prescriptive. And we sort of ended up with the worst of both worlds, really, because you had a quite prescriptive code of guidance called Approved Document B, which tended to go to the lowest standards. It had this kind of very typical sort of race to the bottom problem, which can happen with prescriptive regulation, where they set a baseline standard that they expect people to exceed, but everyone just hits that baseline and no more, and often they fall below it. But you also had the issue with, because that guidance wasn't mandatory and the overall mandatory rule was quite vague, it was very difficult to enforce. It was very difficult for the building inspectors to say, you have breached regulations and therefore you must do something else, because you don't know whether a building does or doesn't resist the spread of fire until you set fire to it. So we were in that kind of like limbo position, and people in the UK will argue that the problem was the prescriptive guidance, and then other people will argue that the problem was the performance-based overall law. From my perspective, I think that performance-based regulation is a great idea for a competent industry, but I don't believe that the construction industry, certainly in the UK, is competent enough to have that freedom, unfortunately. I think that the rules need to be simple enough to catch people who are trying to evade them and evade the spirit of them. And they need to be simple enough that building control inspectors, who are probably paid less than the fire engineers who are kind of working out the report for the developer and might not quite have the kind of high level qualifications that you need to make a really careful, holistic assessment of different materials, have a chance of enforcing it. I mean, the guy who assessed Grenfell Tower was not a storied fire engineer. He was a pretty simple local authority representative. He needs clear black and white rules to enforce. If an industry is competent enough that it can regulate itself, that it can reach those standards, that it can innovate safely, and if it's kind of has checks and balances inherent with that industry to ensure that carries on, then I guess I can see how a performance-based system would work. But that is not the nature of the construction industry, certainly in the UK. And the kind of many, many unsafe buildings we have speaks to that. So I think actually the job of regulations is to set high standards and to enforce people who slip below them.
Right. So I guess there's a couple other questions too. I mean, really, this goes back to a lot of systemic problems. It's not, I think you take pains, despite the fact that you tell the story from the perspective of a lot of individuals, many of whom are acting very badly. This is not a story about bad actors and bad apples. This is about a whole, you know, apple bin lined with greed and a zeal for deregulation. You know, is that a fair assessment? And if so, who should be held to account and what should they be asked to do?
I mean, it's a very fair assessment. I think it would have been very convenient, I think, for the UK government to paint this as a bad apple, one-off building, one person who's made some poor choices, and you know, we just come down hard on them, and then that's the problem solved. And there's several things that make that not true. I mean, first is that we've had something like 300 or 400 witnesses come through the Grenfell Tower inquiry because there are so many people involved in this story, and all of them have demonstrated some level of failure. There's also the fact that there's something like 10,000 other buildings with risks, 450 of which are high rises with exactly the same cladding on as Grenfell. That's not, like you say, that is a barrel of bad apples, and that's from an orchard that's producing rotten fruit. It's not a one-off. You also have the fact that this goes very high up. I mean, it's the sort of bad apple scenario kind of is usually, you know, one inspector, one architect, but we're talking the people who are actually in charge of the regulations here were cited on testing that showed that this product was dangerous, and was permitted by our regulations, and decided not to act. I mean, that's how high up the chain it goes, and then up from there to ministers who were putting pressure down on them to deregulate. So it's a system-wide failure, and it's a failure of a philosophy as well, a failure of this idea that you can just let industry get on with it and the good results will come around, instead of the obvious consequence of that, which is people taking care of their bottom line. But I think the second part of your question was then, what do we do about accountability? And that is a difficult question. I mean, the closing statements to the inquiry did make that clear. If you just say this was a systemic failure where it's not about individuals, how do you hold individuals to account? And I think that the way I see that is, you know, even if there was lots of individual failure going on in the industry at the time that this happened, then there was one instance where that individual failure resulted in these horrendous consequences. And therefore, those individuals, even if they weren't doing anything that other people in the industry weren't doing as well, still deserve to be held to account. I mean, the analogy I've used before is it's a bit like the difference between dangerous driving, which is, you know, something which you shouldn't do, and causing death by dangerous driving. You know, you were both driving at 90 miles an hour along the motorway. One of you caused a collision which killed people. The law is going to treat you more harshly than it treats the other driver, and that's because the consequences of your actions were so serious. And so I do think it's important. I think it's important for the future as well that it's shown that people in the industry see that if something like this happens and there are consequences like this, that there will be individual accountability, because otherwise you know, that's the clearest way, I think, to stop people doing this again, really, is to say, well, there'll be consequences for it. It would be easy to sort of forgive everyone because other people were making errors as well. But I think that would let the victims of this fire down. You know, the fact that these mistakes had these consequences mean they are more serious.
And the legislation as it currently stands on ACM, obviously this isn't the only root of the problem, as you point out pretty directly in the book. You know, there were issues with evacuation standards, only have a single staircase, the radios didn't work properly inside the concrete building with the fire rescue team. There may be any number of pieces of legislation could be expected to come out of this. What do you think about the ACM legislation as currently applied, and what more should be done?
So the ACM, I mean, just for any of your readers who aren't familiar with it as a product, it's two very thin sheets of aluminium bonded together with polyethylene, pure polyethylene. Polyethylene is chemically about the same as petrol, really. It's the same sort of thing. It's just petrol in its solid form. And so if you expose that panel to a fire, aluminium has a relatively low melting point. Polyethylene has quite a low ignition point. So it's gonna burn, and it's gonna burn very fiercely because, you know, it's petrol, and it's petrol packed together in a very dense form. If it's stacked up in a straight line, it's gonna go up like it did at Grenfell. And the thing is, we've got loads of testing now, which shows that that is not a one-off accident, unusual effect. I mean, not just testing. There's tests in the UK from 2001. The manufacturer of the product, Arconic, had tests in 2004. Those tests were then repeated in 2011, 2016, with the same results, a huge, violent fire. After Grenfell, it's been tested again by the UK government. Same thing, 30-minute test, has to be terminated after 7 or 8 minutes because the fire is so ferocious that the laboratory that is carrying it out is put at risk. So they have to call the test to a halt. That's what happens when this stuff gets set alight. In the UK, it is now banned. It's banned on buildings at all heights. It's being removed retroactively from buildings of 11 metres and higher, although not below that, which is a point of controversy. What hasn't happened is I don't think that there's been a recognition globally, because this product was actually sold by a US headquartered company, Arconic. They're based in Pennsylvania. It was their French arm which sold the panels for Grenfell. And they weren't just selling into the UK market. They were selling into the market in Spain, in Italy, in the Middle East, possibly in the US, I don't know. This product is, you know, if it burns like this in London, it's going to burn like this in Milan. And we saw that. There was a building in Milan with ACM panels that burned, destroyed the building back in summer 2021. And, you know, I really do think there's got to be an international response and international regulators. You know, it is possible to ask these ACM manufacturers to open their books, tell us where they've sold this product, and even if you don't do a full-scale remediation, at least make sure that everybody can get out of that building very fast if a fire starts. So I think that's the real flaw, really. I mean, the UK, it's the sort of most basic thing you could ask the UK to do is ban that product and make sure that where else it's been used, it's removed. And that is happening in the UK. I don't think that there's been any recognition outside of the borders of the country where Grenfell happened, except possibly in places like Australia, that this is fire risks are never, they don't respect national boundaries, you know, so something burns the same in every country. So I think I would like to see some understanding about that and some effort in other jurisdictions to understand where this product's been sold and what is being done to make sure that you don't have a fire like Grenfell occurring in a large US or a Mexican or another city in Europe.
Thank you. Yeah, I mean, this is also a sort of a story about privatization, isn't it? I mean, the BRE, if you go to the BRE site today, by the way, that's the, I believe it used to stand for the British Regulatory something, but it was part of the government. And if you look for it now, it is very, very hard to find what the abbreviation actually stood for, is because it's been a privatized company. They set the they award the BREEAM standard, which is the excellence in environmental engineering, similar to the US GBC's LEED standard. But they do a lot of other things too, including set safety standards and do inspections. When did that get privatized, and what has been the outcome?
So, yeah, the BRE was privatized in 1997 in the UK. Like you say, previously it was part of the British state, going right back to World War One. You know, Britain was in a pretty poor state after World War One. It needed to be rebuilt. The government wanted scientific knowledge about the built environment to kind of help inform those policies that they were introducing. The BRE basically was the place where UK governments over the century through which it's existed
learned about the science of the built environment in order to make safe, appropriate policies. It was privatized in 1997. And so then if it was going to advise government, which it continued to do and continues to do, actually, it has to win a contract as a commercial organization. But as well as that, it also wins contracts from other commercial organizations, particularly the manufacturers of insulation products. So now you have a company which is getting contracts from private companies who want to sell their products into the market, and contracts from government who set the regulations covering those products. And that's an enormous conflict of interest, because if they say, well, this product is actually not safe and we should ban it, then the other side of their business is making a huge loss, and they've upset all of their clients. And so you have this position where even if they didn't do that, that conflict of interest exists. And the advice that the BRE gave to government over the years that it was a private organisation was inappropriate. The inquiry has shown that, and the BRE witnesses have admitted it. And they also were involved in sort of running safety tests on products, that some of which ended up in use on Grenfell Tower, which were just not robust enough. You know, that you can't have the situation where the person running the safety test that determines whether or not this product is available on the market is have a client relationship there, because how do you get repeat business from someone if you fail their product? And that's a problem for the BRE. It's also been shown to be a problem for other regulatory agencies in the UK that are involved in this story. And I'm sure it's something that applies outside the context of cladding, and probably even outside the context of the built environment. We've privatized a lot of our regulatory apparatus without really thinking, well, what are the long-term consequences of that? What are the conflict of interests that we've introduced as a result?
Peter, I was wondering if you could step back for a second from just the pure regulation and the sort of professional context of this to a larger UK political context, if you're willing to indulge me here as well, because this discussion takes against the backdrop. Obviously, the backdrop, of course, the current government, as an American, it was bracing to me to see the phrase stop the boats, and of course see this whole discussion about immigration and also discussions about the privatization of council housing, which in the States there is at least a glimmer on the American left here about restoring some sort of socialized housing as part of a, you know, YIMBY home building agenda in the United States that would have market and public alternatives. I'm curious your larger thoughts on, I mean, what will change under the current government? Will public housing, council housing continue to be demonized as a place for the poorest and for migrants? What would it take a larger change? I mean, without waving a wand and I guess putting in some sort of mythical Labour government to do that. But will these larger changes take place given the sort of context of Brexit and the UK economy and the UK government? And I ask this on behalf of, again, of our American listeners who are at this point, we're vaguely following Brexit.
Well, you're probably doing more to follow it than most people in the UK, if you're still keeping in touch with it, at least vaguely, to be honest. I mean, I think that's a really interesting question. It's quite difficult to give kind of a headline answer to. I mean, I think one of the things that really struck me was it was the fifth anniversary of the fire on the 14th of June last year. And you had sort of government ministers turning up at the tower and offering their platitudes and sort of wearing their green heart badges and making these sort of speeches about how this will never happen again and the lessons have been learned and all this sort of thing. But on the same day, the lead political story in the UK was a government plan to fly asylum seekers to Rwanda in Eastern Africa so that their asylum applications could be processed there. So they were at that point involved in a legal battle with human rights charities who were trying to stop this flight taking off, and they were using all of these kind of from my perspective, horrendous descriptions of people who are fleeing, you know, horrendous circumstances to try and find a safer life. It's not lost on me, and it's not lost on the community, that some of the people who died in the Grenfell Tower fire were asylum seekers. You know, it's not everybody. Like, there was a broad mix of ethnicities and class backgrounds and all of that sort of thing in a tower. It's a bit of a kind of myth to say that everybody there was poor and struggling. But there were some guys from Syria who'd escaped, who'd come to the UK, find a better life, and very, very, very tragically died in the fire. There is a part of this question which is about compassion, you know, from a government level about, and while the government has been very keen to express those emotions towards Grenfell, their wider policy setup suggests that is not the intention. And I think you kind of even see that since Grenfell, another thing that's happened, there is still quite a large public housing sector in the UK. Somehow we've managed to retain one. Recently there was a case of a 2-year-old boy. He, the conditions in his flat, the young child called Awa Bishak, were so it was full of kind of black mold and damp, and he died of a respiratory infection, and a coroner's inquest decided that it was the conditions of his home that were the cause of his death, which is quite a profound thing for a coroner to say. It's very unusual for it to be that definitive. And that has kind of the UK government sort of going into sort of almost pulling itself apart, because on the one hand there's a lot being done, you know, the people who provide the social housing are really kind of being taken to task by the government for poor conditions, you know, they're increasing the regulation of that sector, that they seem to be taking it quite seriously. But at the same time, we had our budget setting announcements this week from the government, and that there's no money in there to fix any of those problems. There's you know, we've got real problems in the UK with sort of rising rates of homelessness at the moment in the UK, which could be corrected by sort of just moderate changes to levels of housing benefit. But that's not being done. So you sort of have... The government is careful around Grenfell to talk compassionately and to sort of talk the good talk, but you really do see the character of their kind of truer nature come through when the sort of broader questions, and particularly when questions about spending come up.
That does bring me to a question, which is around you know, who pays for all of this remediation? What is the vehicle for getting the cladding off of all these buildings, and you know, how is that burden shared between industry and the government? And I guess a sort of last question to that would be the other practice or emerging practice that comes under criticism in the book a little bit is the implementation of, you know, modular housing and some other solutions that are cheaper to construct, faster to construct, use less labor. We're amidst a housing crisis where people need to, you know, have housing that's affordable. If we suddenly go backwards on perhaps much needed legislation for building safety, does that then put the production of affordable housing at risk? Or were people just not really producing affordable housing in the first place? I'm just wondering the context of all this, you know, where's the money going? Where's it coming from?
There's several very perceptive and very interesting questions in there. So I'll sort of try and say as much as I can on each of them. I mean, the question about who's paying, I guess you could say that's kind of become, in quite a sad way, really. I mean, that's become the core policy question in the 5 or 6 years since Grenfell. The remediation bill is vast. The best estimates are somewhere in a region of £15 billion. I think that that's an underestimate, really. The particular problem in the UK is that the way the law was set up at the time of the Grenfell Tower fire, the law gave that bill to the residents. So that if you'd have bought a flat in London with, you know, you've done all the checks, you think it's absolutely fine, you've moved in, you suddenly find out in sort of 2019 or 2020 that you're going to get a 20 to 50,000 pound bill to remediate it. And that happened. That's happened to people. They were suddenly receiving these bills. And the government really didn't have any answers. It had no idea, frankly, how to get itself out of that problem. And most of its attempts to do so made the situation worse. We've now kind of progressed slightly. There is a restriction on passing those bills on to residents. There is quite tough legislation to force bigger developers to put their hands in their pockets to pay for it, with a kind of penalty of effectively losing the right to build homes if they fail to do so. And that is getting some money out. It's starting to bleed some money out, which is going and into it and starting to kind of grease the wheels of this frankly enormous remediation job that the country has to do. It's not quite enough yet, and the government is gonna the approach campaigners want the government to take is to effectively underwrite it in the first instance. You pay for this through the state's powers, but then use the state's power as a kind of legislative authority to go and get that money from the people who are responsible. And therefore kind of, okay, you might put £15 billion up front, but if you take a longer view over kind of 30 or 40 years, you're actually going to claw that money back from the organisations who are to blame. That remains to me, I mean, all of the clever solutions we've attempted, I think we're going to get somewhere close to that happening, or else just these buildings aren't going to get fixed. It seems to be the only way. I think you asked me about modular housing as well, which you're right, it does come up kind of tangentially in the book. I think my position on modular housing is a little bit more nuanced than may have come across. I agree with you about the business case for it. The traditional construction sector is under... It needs to transform. I mean, like the for all sorts of reasons. And modular offers this kind of really... It feels like a good solution because of the speed, because of the volume that you can produce. And, you know, modular isn't that new. I mean, we've been trying that in the UK in one way or another for about 100 years. But I think my problem is that a modular building comes with a different set of risks to one built of masonry and concrete, fundamentally. Huge cavities, potentially combustible building materials. And okay, yeah, you might have precision engineered the modules in a factory, but has the guy who put them together on a rainy building site in a day and a half fitted the cavity barriers sufficiently? And the answer to that is too frequently no. My problem with the UK government's approach to modular really is that it's kind of just tried to slot modular into a regulatory regime which assumes the building is made out of steel and concrete. And so they just say, well, of course, we know that when this building catches fire, the individual unit will hold the fire in there for 2 hours and the fire brigade can go in and put it out. And that's just not true. It's not the case in a modular building. We've seen hotels burnt to the ground. You know, we know once the fire starts getting through that structure, it can destroy it. And I don't think that means we should ban modular, but I do think that means that we should have a set of rules and regulations which take that risk into account and mitigate it. And frankly, I find the modular industry in the UK quite frustrating, because if I was in their shoes, I would argue for that. Because if there's one big fire where... it hits the headlines, and everyone sort of thinks, wow, modular housing isn't safe, then that's the end of the industry, safe or unsafe. That's the, that will kill the industry faster than regulations will. So I would want, if I was in that industry, to chase the bad practices out with tough regulation and make sure you're building safe homes, because it's not unlike cladding, really, in the same sense. Like, if you want to know what stopped the use of combustible cladding in the UK wasn't tighter regulations, it was loose regulations, because loose regulations put us in a position where we had a huge fire and now no one wants that cladding and it's banned. And that will be the future of modular housing unless it's properly regulated. So I think we should use it. I think that it is probably the way forward for some of these kind of inherent problems that we've got in construction. But please, if you love that industry, beg for it to be properly regulated is what I would say to anyone kind of engaged in it. And that doesn't always happen.
Peter Epps, author of Show Me the Bodies, How We Let Grenfell Happen. Thank you so much for joining Unfrozen today.
Well, thank you for inviting me. I enjoyed the chat.